This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about the lasting effects of traumatic experiences on families and finding out how different patterns of behavior are passed down from generation to generation. To learn more, we're joined now by Susana Mariscal, who will be joining us for the hour, associate professor at Indiana University School of Social Work and the director of Strengthening Indiana Families. Welcome to the program, Susana.
Thank you very much, Miriam. I really appreciate being here. I'm really excited to talk about this topic, and you know, I'm sort of obsessed with the movie Encanto, so thank you for having me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait to talk about Encanto in a little bit, but let's start with sort of the definition of what intergenerational trauma is for folks who may be hearing this for the first time.
Oh, absolutely. So when we talk about intergenerational trauma, we talk about the ongoing impact of traumatic events or, you know, situations, natural disasters, for instance, that happen in prior generation and continues to impact the current generation or, you know, generations after that event occurred. So it started in the 60s. You know, this idea of intergenerational trauma, it started in the 60s when, clinical psychologists realized that a group of children were referred to psychological services because they were having PTSD, depression, and anxiety in very much higher rates than what was expected of their group. That group of children were children of survivors of the Holocaust. So that really started this idea that trauma could be passed, you know, like that the consequences of trauma could be influencing the next generations. And they could be influencing because we are more vulnerable to develop mental health symptoms, you know, like some problems with PTSD, depression, anxiety. We may be able to be more vulnerable also, like we may be more vulnerable to develop substance use disorders. And that has to do with our relationship with our parents. So it's basically in that, especially in the first years of life when we are developing that attachment, and if our parents, if our parent is not available, maybe due to the same trauma that they experienced, if they're not nurturing, if a child does not feel that they are safe, protected, loved, it is hard for them to engage and develop fully to their potential as adults.
When it comes to intergenerational trauma, just so I can understand and make sure that I'm clear on this, sure. Can we trace it back? So for example, if I have anxiety, could I trace that back and say, well, 3-4 generations ago, there was a horrific incident that your ancestors or relatives went through that has been passed down? Can it pass down, or is it just certain, maybe it's like your grandparents, or can it go further back?
So it has to do more like with it's a combination of your vulnerability and that history, and also your current experiences. So let me explain, for example, this situation. We have, let's say, a traumatic event that occurred in the 1920s. Okay. So the people that were affected by that developed certain patterns of interactions. And for example, the lack of availability, you know, not being warm, being constantly in that survival mode. That's how those parents behave. So there is a vulnerability. It's not that it's going to be a direct effect, but in the next generation, that child did not receive that nurturing, engaging, did not feel completely safe. So maybe they developed behaviors that were not fully healthy, you know, to be able to cope with that relationship. But then that's the pattern that they learn in terms of how they relate to others, and especially around parenting. So we tend to repeat what we saw and what we learned in our families, unless we become aware that that's how we do it, right? So if you saw your parents deal with anxiety in a way that is not healthy, then you tend to develop similar coping skills for that moment when you feel anxious. So anxiety and fear are very closely together, connected, right? So fear, you have something that is in front of you. So if you have a bear in front of you, that is a normal reaction to be afraid because, you know, it, you are experiencing danger. But anxiety, you don't really have that thing, that object. The bear is not there, but you still feel the fear. See what I'm saying? So it's so you are developing a reaction that may not, like the coping is still around that, may not be healthy because that's what you learn from others. It's not really, oh, because of the traumatic event, that's what it's all connected because I learned the patterns from how it all started. So the next generation learns some patterns and the next generation learns some patterns. We still have the ability to connect to other things and become aware of what we're doing and still change it. So there isn't really a direct connection. Don't forget that there is also resilience, that we do have protective factors that may shield us from all of that.
And that's something I was thinking about, too, is as some folks may not be as vulnerable to some of these experiences. They, you know, someone from the same family might be totally like, oh, I didn't even realize all the stress was happening. And then somebody else could be like, my entire childhood was the most stressful thing I've ever experienced.
Exactly. Because not even if you grew in the same, even if you grew up in the same family, your experience of your parents, if you compare it to the experience of your siblings, can be totally different. How you perceive them and how you related to them and how they were because of many circumstances.
Right, right. You know? So the baby of the family really does get the best of everything, right?
Sometimes, it's not always. So sometimes it does happen, but it's not like, you know, there are studies around which child receives more attention and all of that. Actually, there are studies that show that the younger one is basically more raised by the siblings, right, in connection with the siblings. They get away with more things because people are not paying attention to them. And probably the younger child is the one that is more people-pleasing because they learn how to navigate social relationships more efficiently in that sense. But people-pleasing is also a trauma reaction. You know, it's a trauma response. People-pleasing, perfectionism, and you see it in the movie, people-pleasing, perfectionism, that need to help others and put others' priorities over yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another way of a traumatic response. Being a workaholic, you know, being completely devoted to something where you forget about yourself, it's also, it may be connected to a traumatic event in prior generations too.
How would someone know if they've grown up with generational trauma? Are there signs they can look out for? Is it something people should even be concerned about unless it's affecting their lives?
Okay, I'm going to talk about some of the most important forms in which you can see that the intergenerational trauma passing down generation from generation. Violence is one of the most important, one of the most negative and most important inheritances in terms of intergenerational trauma. Violent pattern relationships, you know, relationships of whether it's domestic violence, whether it's physical abuse, whether it's sexual abuse, emotional abuse. We tend to repeat in the next generation a violent pattern. And that comes from the precisely of how that goes. So if somebody hurts me, my body stops being mine. Right, like I don't own my body because that person actually can has power over me, especially if I am a child. When we talk about, for example, child sexual abuse, there are many negative consequences of child sexual abuse. And why is it repeated? Because it creates a lot of shame and guilt. And because of the shame and guilt, victims tend to keep it secret. So it tends to repeat in the next generation. So the person that probably abused this child, the person that abused me, is likely to abuse another child and more children. And maybe that person was also abused by a parent or an uncle, a grandparent. And that's how it continues because of the secrecy, because of the shame and the guilt. So let's talk about domestic violence. Same thing. So I see my parents, you know, that I am afraid because I see my parents fighting, but then I see my father physically abusing my mother. And then, but I think at the same time that my father loves my mother. And in my head, love and violence can coexist. So then when I grow up and I start having, you know, a boyfriend, like my first relationships or even down the road, to me, if I experience violence, it may be okay, because that's what happens. That's how things are. So I don't know how to see something different, because that's how I interpret. Love and violence can coexist. And that's how they get passed down in generation after generation. The way to stop it is really when you become aware of that and you start getting the supports to be able to overcome that, bringing awareness, you know, speaking about it is you get surprised about how the others in your family talk about it, you know, talking to your cousins, talking to your siblings about your experiences growing up, can bring awareness of what it is and start moving away the shame and the guilt around any of those experiences. But it also can bring healing to the family as a whole. When we talk about, for example, immigration experiences, nobody immigrates if they have everything they need in their country of origin. So they're moving, they move to a new country because something is missing. So whether it is opportunities, whether it is that they need, you know, a safe space because there is too much violence in their country, because they're being persecuted, because they're being killed. So depending on those experiences also, we bring that experience with us. And there are very high expectations for the next generations. Mm-hmm. The behaviors are going to affect us, all of us, right? Like, let's say my parents came to this country, but I am navigating the culture that my parents want and the culture where I'm living.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about this when we come back after a quick break. We are discussing the impact of intergenerational trauma on families and how to heal from it. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about the effects of intergenerational trauma on families, what that trauma can look like, and how people can heal from it. We're joined by Susanna Mariscal, associate professor at Indiana University School of Social Work and the director of Strengthening Indiana Families. Susanna, we were talking about immigrants and sort of the experience of folks that are immigrating and maybe some of the trauma that can be associated with that. I think you mentioned sort of the expectations, and I'm thinking about how you're trying to navigate a culture that, let's say, you're born here into this culture and this is your identity, but your parents have expectations from their own cultural baggage they brought with them. How does that factor into things?
Oh, that creates a huge pull in two directions, right? So you're pulled by the culture in which you are participating, which is, you know, your schools, your school, your friends, every other area of your life except your family life. And the family values that your parents are pulling you also to adhere to. So it's really challenging for children of immigrants to navigate those two different expectations. A common thing among, for example, Latinx families is a sleepover. Sleepovers are very common in America, right? And that's something that most children enjoy. But it is really difficult for some children to say, okay, can I have a sleepover? Because that's not something that Latinx families would agree so easily to. You do that with your family, but not with everybody, you know, like not with anybody in the community, like friends and stuff like that. So it's really challenging, because that's the most normal thing. Going out with friends would be like also different expectations. You know, some cultures have these gender stereotypes around what girls can do versus what boys can do. And of course, it is important to change all of those. But there are still those expectations that come from those cultures of origin. And it is really hard to navigate that. That can create a lot of friction and a lot of anxiety also for the younger generations. And it is trying to navigate that. And at the same time, there are very high expectations, right? When we talk about resilience, in terms of the environment, we can do, like, there are three factors that have been identified repeatedly in the literature around what really the environment can do to promote resilience among children. And it's really caring relationships, you know, having that single person, whether it's your family member, whether it's a parent, whether it's a coach, a mentor, a teacher, somebody in your life that makes you feel loved, protected, safe, mm-hmm. and understood. So that person is critical for resilience. The second one is high enough expectations. So when we talk about having those very high unreachable expectations of, I need to be a straight A student, I need to do everything perfect, I need to not have any single mistake, there is way too much pressure that creates a lot of stress, anxiety, and possibly depression in children. Because parents came here, let's say, with an idea of a dream, or this is what we're going to do, and we're doing this for our children, so our children have more opportunities. So those children need to actually take advantage of all those opportunities, and there is a lot of pressure on them to actually succeed and give back to their families after they achieved all those dreams. So it's really, really hard when those high expectations are too high and they're not negotiated with the youth. So when we have expectations and we want our children to develop healthily, it is important to navigate those expectations together. The third one has to do with opportunities for participation and really having a voice and also contribute, you know, in to society, to the community. So those are the three things. But again, I'm going to keep bringing up resilience because when we talk about trauma, many times we see it as we're done, right? Like mm-hmm. we experience trauma, we're going to have to deal with all of the consequences. And it's true. I mean, like, trauma does have very negative consequences, but we also have protective factors that can be activated precisely when we face difficulties, and we can overcome overcome those challenges and actually develop our resilience.
I'm just thinking about so many things that I can relate to with the stuff that you were talking about. You know, it's interesting. Earlier you mentioned, I think that these studies were started maybe in the 60s, and mm-hmm. I've only heard about it really spoken about in the last few years as more of a big topic. And I've right. often felt that some people think it's an excuse that people are using, like, just get over it. Now it's intergenerational. Like, okay, it's enough for you to say that you are stressed or you have anxiety, but now you're going to blame your parents and your grandparents, you know? So what are your thoughts on that?
Actually, understanding that what you're experiencing is intergenerational, more than blaming your parents, brings awareness and understanding of your parents. They did the best they could do with what they had at that moment. I truly believe that all parents are trying their best. You know, that most parents are trying their best, that most parents want the best for their children. So it is when we understand that they had incredibly challenging situations and they still were able to provide for us or care for us, then it is much easier to make amends. It is much easier to heal. You know, it's not that they wanted you to go through this. They didn't know better.
Yeah. I mean, I can totally see that. And I'm just thinking from my own experience, you know, my father's an immigrant, my mother isn't. So my experience was navigating two different worlds in one household. So it was interesting. And I think, as you mentioned, like, when you talk with your siblings, and it's funny because, like, the younger siblings are like, oh, we got to do anything and everything. I'm like, we weren't allowed to do half this stuff. Like, what, where did this split happen?
Yes. Because at some point they basically were like, you know, it seems that when they did this, it wasn't that bad. So it's like they're testing the waters with the first ones, you know, like the first one doesn't get to do anything. The second one gets to do a little, and that's a little bit, it's like they go testing waters. You know, I think that all parents are trying to figure out things, you know, like kids are very challenging, like kids constantly challenge their parents, right? Like that's their job. Like, whenever you figure out that you can do that, that this is what works with this child. It may not work for the other one, and it may not work for the same kid 2 years later. So it's constantly figuring out things. So that's what it was, testing the waters.
Yeah. And I think when you have kids, if you're privileged to be able to have kids, that also is another thing where I, at least for myself, I feel like I'm hyper aware now, like, am I passing down bad habits? Like, exactly. They're probably going to come back to me, you know, when they're older and tell me like half the stuff I did was wrong. So I'm ready for it.
And the truth is that it's, I feel that, you know, understanding that intergenerational trauma plays a role in the way that we learn how to relate to one another, in the way that we relate to be parents. It's really, in the way that we learn to parent, it's really humbling, right? Because that's exactly what we need to do. It's understanding that we're not going to be perfect. Understanding that perfection is actually a fantasy, right? That we cannot achieve that, and that we're trying our best, and that we're getting all the information that we can, and that we are really as aware as we can be of all the things that we want to change. So it is really, when we navigate the two cultures, for instance, as children of immigrants, it is understanding that we actually have two sets of values that we can choose from. I mean, it's we have more, you know, we have two languages. We have two, like, we navigate two cultures. We're bicultural. So it's fascinating. It's when you see it from a strengths view, you actually get much more, and you get like you, when you realize that you have the ability to choose what you want from the previous generation for your children, it is a very empowering feeling. You get to decide, and you get to say, okay, for example, abuse, violence, that's not going to happen to the next generation. It stops with me. And that is, you know, that commitment, even if you know, you slip, even if there are hiccups, that commitment to transforming the way that the next generations interact, and that we move away from violence, it is a critical one for the healing of the next generation. So it's like, I call it a sacred work, because I feel that it's really much more than just saying, okay, it's a decision that I make. I feel that you are involving a lot of that intergenerational inheritance too. And I feel that to do something like that, you need to sort of bring in not just your strengths, but all the strengths of your family. We don't only inherit violence or trauma. We also inherit strengths, protective factors. We inherit wisdom. We inherit survival stories, empowering stories from prior generations. I heard when I was growing up many times, you come from a family of very strong women. And to me, that has been true all my life. And, you know, I have a grandmother. Well, I have my grandmother passed, but my grandmother was a single mother in the 1930s in Bolivia, like unheard of. You know? So she became a widow, and she decided to do things on her own, and then she remarried, and she didn't wait for the town to approve who she married, you know. So those things, that wisdom of you come from very strong women that get to decide, that get to transform, that get to take leadership. Wow, it get passed down too. So it's also focusing on that too. So I don't know why I was talking about that.
No, that's great. It's all very fascinating to me. And for folks who are listening live right now, if you have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That number again is 866-476-3881. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Susana Mariscal, Associate Professor at Indiana University School of Social Work and the Director of Strengthening Indiana Families. And we're talking about the effects of intergenerational trauma. I want to ask you, Susana, how can folks heal from generational trauma on an individual level? I think you gave us some sort of insight, like focusing on maybe sort of the positives and the strength and things like that. Is there a difference between healing on an individual level versus on a family level?
I think so. I think that, I'm going to talk a little bit about Encanto in that sense. So there is a huge healing of the whole family in the movie, right? So that involves that connection, talking to each other, helping each other understand what's going on, become much more aware of this inheritance. And at the same time, there is reparation. There is the realization of the prior generations of their behavior, and there is changed behavior, not just intention. So that obviously involves everybody, and it starts as a snowball, right? Like one moves to other, that one connects with other, that one connects. So it actually can create a whole lot of change. But therapy is one of the ways in which you can support this healing individually. But therapy is not enough. And that's something that we need to understand, especially when we talk about minoritized communities that are especially, or that have been systematically exploited, oppressed, that have endured repeated abuse, racism, poverty, lack of access to participation and you know, benefits in the community. So obviously that becomes much more difficult. However, I think that the key to any, so when we talk about trauma and we talk about, for instance, substance use, we talk about violence, we talk about suicide, the key is connection. The key is feeling that caring relationship, that support from the community. So I feel that if we want to really transform the way in which families are interacting and provide support so that not just your family, but other families in the community start healing and start developing better patterns of relationship and communication, we need to start supporting them from a community perspective. So that's really a much more, let's say, a macro approach to this healing, right? It's thinking about families, that all families need that support, that all parents need help at some point. So that's why we need to approach it from a society, like, you know, from a community standpoint, and say, okay, what can we do so that families have the supports and connection they need? And that was, for instance, the response that my project, the Strengthening Indiana Families, is having for in four communities in Indiana, Delaware, Tipton, Grant, and Madison counties. We created family resource centers that are precisely that, you know, a space in which families can be connected and feel supported. And it's like a one-stop shop where they can come and just connect to other parents, connect to resources, just chill, relax, enjoy their children. We have family fun events. You know, it's creating those opportunities for family to strengthen their bond, to build on their protective factors, to reduce the risk factors. So it's like really providing concrete supports, providing childcare, you know, providing other things that families need. And that's a critical need in Indiana. So we're still trying to find ways to improve that too. So,
and that's through, can you repeat again the organization?
It's the Strengthening Indiana Families Project. We are funded by the Federal Children's Bureau. And it is a 5-year project to provide these family resource centers in central Indiana. So we're doing that. We have a model that is based on resilience and protective factors. And we are providing that because that's exactly how, if we want to create transformation in the next generation, if we want to really support parents to be, you know, the best to the best that they can, if we want to transform those patterns of communication and interaction, it is necessary that we bring the community to support families.
Absolutely. Well, we will be taking a quick break. And when we come back, I promise we're going to start talking about Encanto because I can't get the song out of my head. we're talking about generational trauma and how to heal from it. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're speaking with Susana Mariscal, Associate Professor at Indiana University School of Social Work and the Director of Strengthening Indiana Families, on the lasting effects of intergenerational trauma on families and what it might look like and how to heal from it. Encanto, the Disney movie, has sparked a lot of discussion. A lot of articles have been written about how the movie tackles intergenerational trauma. What do you think about the movie and a children's movie specifically focusing on a heavy topic like this?
I feel that Encanto did a fantastic job capturing intergenerational trauma and the trauma responses of different family members. And also, it provided a venue like, you know, so that even vicariously, we could have some of that healing, you know, from the voice of this grandmother that actually acknowledges how she did wrong and acknowledges this process of change and actually embraces this process of change. It was really amazing. I really love it. I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, we have the songs on repeat here.
True. Yes.
But I guess, you know, I'm thinking like it is powerful when you have somebody, a matriarch, for example, who went through all this hardship. I mean, just this is from the movie and I'm trying not to spoil it too much for people who may not have seen it yet. But, you know, went through all of this hardship and is trying to hold on as much as she can. But in the end realizes maybe that's kind of the issue.
Right. Right. And you can see, for instance, like, when we talk about trauma responses, I'm talking about the freeze, flight, fight, and the fawn, the, you know, appeasing or pleasing. So those are the four typical responses to trauma. So when we see Encanto, you see very clearly examples of the flight and the fawn, right? So it's like you have Luisa. I mean, Luisa is just a fantastic character, and you know, she says it out loud, no problem. I'm pretty sure I'm worthless if I can't be of service, right? So it's really defining your value based on the others and putting other people's priorities over your own. So that is absolutely, you know, a typical trauma response and that pressure that she feels and the song, you know, and it absolutely captures what the indicators that you were asking me for before. Mm-hmm. So if you're feeling something like that, check where it's coming from. Is it coming from expectations that you are setting? Is it coming from expectation that somebody else is setting? Who is setting those expectations and why is that important to you? A critical indicator is for, you know, to recognize the trauma, intergenerational trauma, it has to do with boundaries. Are there healthy boundaries? Do you have no boundaries? What boundaries do you have and how do you set them? What happens if you set boundaries? You know, and what are the responses of your family if you set boundaries? So for instance, you know, exploring this new, the new possibility, Isabella is the perfect golden child. That's how the movie presents her, introduces her. She's perfect in every way. She has to do everything perfect. And she talks about how this is difficult and how, you know, it's not that she has the perfect hair all the time. It's not that things just fall. She really struggles to do that. And she has a hard time trying new things, which is also part of the freezing response, but also she is just perfect in every way, right? So she has that high expectation again, and she's even willing to marry somebody who she doesn't want to because of the pressure of the family or what she thinks of the idea of perfection is. So again, so I feel that it's we can see throughout the movie different trauma responses, and you have clearly all the stigma and the responses that usually come around mental health, mental illness, right? So we have, for example, Bruno that has clear symptoms of OCD, right? And he counts, he jumps, he has all these rituals to try and control because there is a need for control. There is too much anxiety and I cannot control anything. And at the same time, he is sort of like the scapegoat. And, you know, Mirabel is also sort of a scapegoat because both of them are not really fitting within what the family expects of them. They're, you know, Mirabel doesn't have a gift, and that obviously is already a no-no for the family that needs to live for, you know, to serve the community. So, yeah.
And to clarify, I mean, intergenerational trauma, it's not just an immigrant experience. It can be anybody going through that.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I mentioned that it can be particularly impactful when you consider that there is not just one single event. Like in the experience of this family, there was an important loss. But when you talk about communities like Native American communities that experience several events, historical trauma, racial trauma, I mean, like we're talking about generations and generations that were impacted by boarding schools and, you know, just the systematic exploitation and oppression and marginalization. So obviously that impacts how you see yourself, how you see your community, your family, and the value. And obviously that increases your vulnerability. At the same time, there are strengths among these communities, right? African-American families have endured hundreds of years of multiple experiences. So we talk about racial trauma and historic trauma that continuously impact. So that's when we talk about ingrained intergenerational trauma, right? Like we have these discussions that not many people understand. I mean, like when you have a child, I am Latina, and until I came to the United States, I never even had to think that I will have to talk with my son when he is, you know, an adult or, you know, a teenager of how to engage with law enforcement or things like that. But that's a common conversation with mothers of color. That is something that we all have to do. So it is, that obviously impacts the way that men of color, young men of color, see themselves and see how the community sees them and what are the expectations around them. So obviously we're talking about increased vulnerability, but at the same time, we need to build the resources, the supports, so that we balance. Resilience is sort of like a math game, right? So we talk about that interplay between vulnerability and protection. So it's what strengths, what assets I have, and what risks I'm facing. And the more supports and assets and strengths I have, the better I'm gonna come out.
Do you think folks ever confuse generational trauma with that's just, you know, we're strong, we're keeping alert all the time, that's just who we are, and they don't realize that's a trauma response and they think it's a strength?
I don't know who says this, but it's like, I So it was like, I was strong, but I didn't know that strong was the only thing I had to be or something like that. You know, it's like, sometimes you don't have an option. You have to be strong in order to survive. So it's a coping skill. And that's the thing. It may be very helpful in this survival situation, but you may actually have difficulties to bring your guard down to be able to relax. And that's another indication. Like, if you have the opportunity and you still cannot relax, so where is this coming from? Why are you not able to? Is that really a strength, or is it a helpful coping mechanism for a survival situation, but then it's not survival anymore? Right now you are not threatened, but you still perceive the fear as if the bear were in front of you. So it's actually recognizing, is the bear in front of me? No. Okay, so I should be able to take off the armor. But if I can't, then it's an important indicator of, okay, I may need to learn when I need to put on the armor and when I can be without the armor. See what I'm saying? It's really learning and being aware. And it only takes that work, right? It's becoming aware and start connecting to the resources. So therapists have fantastic resources. I mean, like, the field of you know, any helping profession, you know, social workers, clinical psychologists, really have fantastic tools in terms of supports for people impacted by trauma. Trauma-informed services are becoming basically a standard for every area. And you have to think, when you're thinking about trauma-informed services, that they need to really build the trust, prioritize safety, be non-judgmental, create that space for collaboration and for people to share their stories and for their individual voices to be heard. And no trauma-informed practice is real trauma-informed practice if it doesn't equalize the power. We need to really remember that. Equity is connected to trauma-informed practice.
And I feel like sometimes it's difficult. I mean, maybe there are more people in this area practicing, but it can be difficult to find practitioners who understand different backgrounds and experiences. So sometimes, I've just heard that it's just really difficult for folks from different backgrounds to find someone that they can relate to.
Yes. We have, like, we did for the Strengthening Indiana Families, we did this needs assessment to identify what services were necessary, what kind of supports we needed, you know, for families to improve the lives of children and families. What we identified is that the quality of service, even if you have, you know, clinicians or you have mental health providers, the quality of service is not the same. Not everybody's trained in trauma-informed practice. And especially there is like a big gap regarding trauma-informed mental health providers for children. So that's one of the biggest gaps that we identified in Indiana. And when we think about, in general, trauma-informed practice, especially that understand the experiences of African-Americans, Native Americans, you know, that understand the marginalization experience, that understand the historic and racial trauma, it is more difficult. That is definitely true.
One thing that you mentioned earlier was navigating expectations together as families to kind of maybe prevent the trauma from happening in the first place. And one thing that I know we only have a few minutes left here. One thing that I've noticed is in immigrant communities, for example, there may not be any boundaries. That's part of the culture. And if you try to put boundaries, that is looked down upon. So how would you advise folks who maybe they want to have that discussion, they want to set some boundaries, but they don't even know where to start?
I'm going to go back to that view of, okay, I have two cultures that I can choose values from. I have two cultures that I can choose different traditions, different activities, different things. I feel that that's another thing. So boundaries are part of that. So I don't need to be completely, I don't need to have a tower protecting me, but I can have or, you know, walls. I don't need to build a great wall of China around me. You know, it's, I can have some boundaries around, like, I'm protecting this time and it is for me. And I need to feel good about it. And that may need some practice or some work, you know, with a therapist. But healthy boundaries don't mean that healthy boundaries are flexible. Healthy boundaries are not going to be rigid in the sense that, oh, I cannot ever do this. But it is like, okay, I may be able to need to help my mom and come to sleep to her house when she is feeling like this or when she needs this kind of support. So instead of saying, I can never come to your house, you know, it's like, see what I'm saying? I'll never sleep in your under your roof again. It's too much of a rigid limit. So it's really understand where I can be flexible with my boundaries. And that definitely can be achieved better with the support of a therapist.
What do you think one of the most important things is for our listeners to take away from today's conversation? I know there's a lot.
We do inherit a lot of vulnerabilities. When there is intergenerational trauma, we're at a higher risk for developing, you know, a mental illness, substance use, all kinds of problems that are going to make our lives difficult, unhealthy patterns of behavior. Perfectionism, we try to please people, we try to do things, we may feel anxiety if we don't do what is expected of us because we feel that, you know, we wouldn't be ourselves if we don't do that. But it's asking ourselves, why do I do that? Where are these expectations coming from? Are people telling me that that's what I need to do? Or what's the voice behind that, right? To identify sort of the voice. And some of them may say, oh, my mom, you know, or my grandmother, or my great grandfather. They may be able to identify that person. And getting the support to work through those expectations with a therapist, with a community program, there are fantastic art programs that can support that. That helps. But also remembering that we are inheriting strengths, that our ancestors, the previous generations, survived tremendous things. And they still sent us all of that. So we can get their wisdom. We can still learn from them in the sense of what strengths they give me. What beliefs do I want to pass down the next generations? So I get a choice once I am aware of it. So the first step is becoming aware of it, then talking, connecting with others in my family to be able to discuss this. And maybe you don't have to do the work alone, and engaging in your community. That's all.
Well, thank you so much. Susanna Mariska is an associate professor at Indiana University School of Social Work and the director of Strengthening Indiana Families. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.